it's getting fuller and fuller every day. Okay, so let's get started. Question number one. Dear Venerable, is meditation about experiencing the present reality? Yes, you've got it. So you can go home now. Are the hindrances ways of distorting and trying to escape from now? Yes, well done. That's what the hindrances do. Desire, the hindrance number one, wanting, it takes you away from now for something in the future, something wonderful and marvelous, which is going to come next, and it never does. So, first hindrance takes you away from the present reality. The second one, ill will, it also pushes you away. You don't like to be here. Sloth and torpor, you can't see the present reality anyway. Restlessness, you're never long enough to stay in the present reality. And doubt as well, you don't know what you're supposed to be doing. So it is very true. Once the hindrances are gone, no more hindrances. There's no other place to be. But right here, right now, where the action is, where life is happening. So, correct, well done. The simile of the two darts. Please elaborate on this very important teaching. Oh, that's the two arrows or the two darts. Whenever your suffering is two sufferings, is a physical suffering and a mental suffering. So the physical suffering, you're old, you're sick, you're falling apart. That's actually most of you on this retreat. And there's nothing much you can do about that. You know, you're getting old, you're getting sick, you're getting tired, joints are beginning to ache. And that's the physical suffering. Or you may get the pain in the guts, the pain in the head, the pain in the teeth, too cold, too hot, stomachache or whatever. That's the physical suffering. But the Buddha said nothing much you can do about that, but a lot of times we add the mental arrow of suffering. I don't want to feel like this. I don't want to have aches. I don't want to feel sort of tired. I don't want to sort of have tummy ache. I don't want. That's all that whining mental arrow. And that's the very worst of all the sufferings. So the Buddha pointed out, whenever you're upset, pain, suffering, there's always two types of suffering. The physical and the mental. The physical is part of life you can't do much about, but the mental you could do a lot about. Instead of, I don't want to be here, I don't want to be in pain, I don't want to have all these problems, I've just been looking forward to this retreat so much, and now my body's falling apart. Unfair. So it's that negativity which we have in the mind, which we add on to the physical feelings. That's a mental error. And that you can do a huge amount about. You can just really take that arrow out. So you have the physical suffering, but the mind is just quite at peace with it. The mind never rejects it. So what you do, you say to the pain, to the aches, if you can't do anything about it, you know, sometimes you move, you sort of lay down, you sort of take an aspirin or whatever, and it's still there. So you say you open the door of your heart to that feeling. Unconditional mindfulness and acceptance of the pain, the difficulties, the cold and heat, the tiredness of life. You can't do much about it. So you just leave it and allow it to be. And if you allow it to be, just most of the suffering disappears. I learned that, the old story about my toothache in Thailand, in the first year I was a monk. Yeah, toothaches aren't that bad, you think, but you know, it was incredibly painful to me at the time. So painful, there's no way you could sleep. So there I was in a jungle monastery, no telephone. Actually, it wasn't even a dentist in Kui, even if you did have a telephone. And no Panadol, no aspirin, nothing in the medical cabinet. And there you had this terrible headache, and as usual, after night time, you know, after the evening chanting, that's when it got worse and worse and worse. I don't know why it always gets worse at night time. As soon as the sun comes up, most pain gets less. But at night time, when you're on your own, in your room, in the darkness, the pain gets worse. And it was really bad, so I couldn't meditate. You know, I could meditate with 70, 80 mosquitoes on me, but I couldn't meditate without pain. Every time you try to watch the breath, breathing in,
is as if, like, as I described it, I think in my book, it's like the pain just kicked down the door of your mind and just came streaming in. And you just couldn't stand it. You couldn't know where you can go to sleep. So I tried walking meditation. And I couldn't do walking meditation because I was doing running meditation. That's what happens, actually, when you get desperate. You can't do anything slow. Then I went up to my room and thought, I can't sit meditation, I can't walk meditation, I can't sleep, what should I do? And you know you have this chanting, this special chanting, things like the Bojanga. It's got these magical powers. You know, the Buddha sort of chanted this and people's sicknesses just went away. Remember, I was a theoretical physicist, so I didn't believe any of that sort of stupid, sort of superstitious nonsense. But nevertheless, I chanted anyway. When you're desperate, you do anything. So I started chanting, and I had to stop chanting. Because I was shouting the chanting. Because when you're in pain, you can't do anything. You even talk loudly. And then you got into this wonderful position. These beautiful moments in life. It was just so painful. And I just, nothing I could do. I tried everything. Every strategy I knew. And it wasn't working. And I just could not stand that pain a moment longer. So what did you do? Just what you've heard so many times. Let go. I didn't have any choice. So I did let go. And it was an amazing experience. Just the pain, the physical, well, you know, basically the pain just vanished in a moment. There was agony, and the next moment, nothing. Actually, it wasn't nothing, it was like bliss. And I just couldn't believe what had happened. Just, you know, much better than taking something, even morphine. I'd never taken morphine, I don't know what it's like, but just a painkiller, just in a moment, incredible pain, and then bliss come afterwards. And it was amazing to actually to experience that. You know, you realize, now from that, 99% of pain is mental, I don't want. The physical stuff is very small. And you only can do that when you really have to. You know, your back's against the wall, nothing else you can do, so you just let it be. And then it goes. So that's the mental arrow. And the mental arrow is just the worst of all. And you can do a lot, sir. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle, let it be. Stop fighting it. You can't do anything about it. So just allow it to be. And as soon as you allow it to be, it's very easy to tolerate. Especially in the present moment. Most times pain we can't tolerate because we go into the future. We fear, how long is this going to last? I can't stand this another minute. See, another minute, which is a problem. Stay in the present moment, and there's no difficulty at all. It's just a feeling. So that can be done. I've done that. Other people have done that. You take out the mental arrow, and it gives you a lot of confidence that you can take pain. Because you know exactly what to do. Yeah, you, so, you know, take the easy way first of all, move the body, take a Panadol or do something like that. But if it really gets bad and there's no Panadol around and nothing works, just let it be. And you find it's incredible just how all that sort of suffering just vanishes. And that's how it's done. You see people like that. Some people are in chronic pain. And you know, they can actually measure sort of on the brain just how much pain they're feeling. There's this one guy used to come to Nolamara temple, and he was on this special group of pain sufferers in Perth. And legally, there's some special law, so he told me, you can take any substance whatsoever if you've got this degree of pain. It's incredible pain sufferers. So you know, any prohibited drug, anything is allowed for you because the pain is so much. And he told me that now, when they measured him on the machines, they could actually tell by just what was happening in the brain, the level of pain. And in order that he could tell other people what he's feeling, because, you know, they say, I'm hurting. Yeah, but how much? It really hurts. Yeah, I hurt very much as well. So what? So they gave, like, a measure of his pain. And he says his measure was exactly the same as you'd feel if your arm was being sawn off. You know, just with a sort of a handsaw. He said, that type of pain, that's what he was feeling all the time. Because they know what that feels like on the brain, what lights up. And that's exactly what he's feeling all the time. He had some terrible back disorder. and so he was allowed anything. But he would come along and just peaceful. No one knew what he was experiencing because he'd learned how to let it be. Because he had to. He had no other choice. And so sometimes people in great pain like that, you find they just get used to it and they accommodate it. And they're just with the pain. They don't try and get rid of it anymore. They've done that, been there, done that, tried to fight it and got nowhere and got even worse. So after a time they just give up and just live life with it. It's amazing what they can do. And they're very admirable people. So, that's what the two arrows are. So, I'll tell you that if you get really, really bad pain, then you know you just learn how to do it very easily. But it's very good to learn how to do it now, just with the moderate pain and discomfort we have. Just stop fighting it. Just let it be. And it just disappears. And that's what the Buddha taught about the two darts. Any comments on that? Someday you'll do that, because sometimes we all experience, everyone from time to time experiences some incredible pain you can't do anything about. And that's what we do, just let it be. So, yeah, go on.
Do you think the Bhujangas help?
Nah, not at all. Because the reason why, I'm going to talk about them tomorrow, that's the subject for the talk tomorrow. The reason why they would help is because they inspired some of the monks who heard this. And they were just about enlightenment factors to people who were enlightened. So what they did, it was Dhamma which really inspired you. No, big time inspiration. You know, like if ever you listen to a Dhamma talk and it really gets you, really gets hold of you, you get so inspired and sometimes you feel like crying, you feel so uplifted, it's beautiful. You don't have any physical feelings or pain when you get inspired that way. So it was just the power of inspiration. So it worked for those people, but then again, we keep on doing it as well, just as a tradition. And you know, sometimes if people believe in it, it works, but it doesn't really work all that much. Unless you're enlightened, and then you remind you about the enlightenment factors. Wow, this is really beautiful. And then, of course, it takes the pain away. So it's much better to take Panadol than get a monk to do chanting for you. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can I expect all hindrances coming up in the same order in every sit, only varying in intensity according to my daily virtue, or having doubt as core hindrance being either reached by overcoming either sloth and torpor or restlessness? Means is sloth and torpor an extreme form of restlessness or another form of ill will towards oneself? Does falling back on sensual desire mean not being able to deal with ill will? I'm not being able to overcome sensual desire, both. In other words, how are these hindrances all related to one another? So, sort of wanting and ill will are, you know, just two sides of the same coin. A lot of times when you don't get what you want, that's when you get frustrated and have ill will. And I've noticed this, is my theory of depression, that because people strive so much, in our Western world we really value the will. So you're told, you know, if you want to succeed, go and do it, go and get it, strive. You know, just like in The Secret, just visualize that check and it will come to you. And all that sort of stuff means, you know, you're sort of creating your will. And sooner or later, doesn't matter how strong your will and how skilled, you will come up against a brick wall when you can't get what you want. Everybody does that. You know, someone as powerful as, you know, President Obama. After a while, just you can't get any further. And people who have lived their life and had a lot of success by exerting their will and got places in the world, when they come across that brick wall, they get incredibly frustrated. And after frustration, just incredible anger. And I've already mentioned that anger consumes a huge amount of energy. And after getting frustration and anger, the next stage is depression. Just so fed up. It's the bigger egos get the biggest depression. Powerful people usually suffer depression. People like Winston Churchill, powerful, a very ego-driven man, if you look at his history, his biography. And because of that power, sometimes frustration, anger, and that consumes so much mental energy that afterwards you've just got nothing left. You're dull and depressed. So they are all connected. From wanting, we get ill will. Wanting an ill will that just consumes all our energy, we just get dull. We're tired. That's why by not wanting very much, not doing very much, resting, you know, your energy starts to come back again. Everybody, if they follow the instructions on a retreat like this, at least they feel healthy, they feel relaxed, they feel at peace because they haven't been draining their mental energy, which is what you do in life. So they are connected in that way. And obviously restlessness as well, when you start to fight your dullness, yeah, when you break through, you're just too agitated. And why are you agitated? Because you've been wanting and fighting. Just like when you fight a war, no one ever wins a war. You know, even in Sri Lanka, the Tamil Tigers are being defeated, but because it's done with force and violence, there's a lot of instability. So same if you fight your demons, yeah, you may conquer them, but there's a lot of instability afterwards, a lot of hatred, a lot of feeling of revenge and victimization. It takes a long time to heal. So it's the same when you fight anything in your mind. You just, when you make war, you have too much damage. It takes years and generations to fix up. So they don't all come in the same order. You know, sometimes, you know, one comes first and then another one comes. But sometimes people say they get an attack of all the hindrances. All five come at once. Now that's impossible. But nevertheless, sometimes people say that's what it feels like. Their mind just goes totally crazy. And the simile of when you get an attack of all the hindrances, when your mind goes absolutely crazy, when you're sitting here and so frustrated and you're going mad, then you use the Nalagiri strategy, which I sort of devised. Nalagiri, the elephant who was fed alcohol and let loose while the Buddha was walking on arms round in the opposite direction. So you can visualize it. This mad elephant, huge, charging, drunk, destroying everything in its path, scattering people in front of him, and people running past the Buddha. There's an elephant coming, get out of the way, it's dangerous. And all these monks, they were supposed to be arahats, they climbed up trees, they jumped over walls. All except Ananda, the faithful disciple of the Buddha. And he stood in front of his master, so sweet, but so stupid. Let the elephant take me. I sacrifice myself for the Buddha. And the Buddha, out of the way, Ananda, I can look after this. And so he faced the elephant alone. Nalagiri, the mad elephant, against the compassionate and peaceful Buddha. Who would win? Who would you put your money on if you were a betting person? Of course, you know, the Buddha's going to win. This is an odds-on favorite. So how did the Buddha defeat this raging elephant? And the Buddha did have psychic powers. Now I said, now I just imagine this. If the Buddha wanted to, he could have just quickly grabbed Nalagiri by the trunk, like some kung fu artist. Quickly grabbed him and twirled him three times around his head. This huge elephant. Just imagine sort of, you know, his feet going right around, three times around his head and then thrown him over the Ganges River. You know, because this happened in Rajagaha. That's about 200 miles away. Easy for a Buddha to do something like that. That would have solved the problem. But that is not how the Buddha works. He's not into violence and power. He was into kindness and compassion. So I imagine the Buddha as this elephant was charging towards him, saying, Nalagiri, the door of my heart is fully open to you, no matter what you ever do to me. You can pick me up with your trunk and smash me against a tree and kill me. You can step on me with your huge feet and trample me like in those Monty Python cartoons I used to see. You can kill me, you can destroy me, but Nalagiri, the door of my heart will always be open to you. I give you unconditional love.
And that's actually according to the story, that's what he did. He gave this powerful metta. And within a few seconds, Nalagiri was bending in front of the Buddha, with the Buddha stroking him. There, Nalagiri. There, Nalagiri. Totally calmed him down. So, that's what you do to your crazy mind. When the mind goes really crazy with an attack of all the hindrances, you say, mind, craziness, madness, the door of my heart's open to you. You can do whatever you want to me. You can send me to Greylands Hospital. That's our local sort of, or Bentley, that's a local sort of place, psychiatric hospitals. You can send me to those hospitals, but mind, the door of my heart's always open to you. So don't fight it with force, even though you may be powerful enough to subdue your mind. Just like the Buddha was more than powerful to subdue Nalagiri, but no. Give it beautiful loving kindness. And in a few seconds, your mind will be, as it were, bending in front of you, with you stroking it there, mind. Shh. It's all right to be crazy. Calm down. And that's actually how it works. So you can try that sometimes. You go absolutely crazy. The meditation's all over the place. Just give it metta. 100%. And it works. You calm down. She got a hand up just first, then Catherine next. Yeah.
That's a very nice effect, describing metta like that.
Yeah.
But how did the Buddha describe metta, loving kindness?
He didn't describe it like that, but he just described just like unconditional love for all beings. It's the unconditional part, no matter what you ever do to me. It's not love with strings attached. It's beautiful kindness, which will never criticize or find fault with anybody, even if they kill you. Yeah, the sword, even if you're sawing, this is the simile of the sword, even if someone captures you and tortures you and saws you limb from limb, he said, if you have even one thought of ill will towards your torturer, you're not a disciple of the Buddha. It's a credible sort of saying by the Buddha. You're being tortured and you still have loving kindness towards your torturers. It's a tough thing to do. The story I said the other day, which is one of my favorite stories, that's actually from the Christian tradition, from the stories of Saint Francis. Because there was this monk, and you know, just like the Buddhist monks, you go on alms round. And so this monk went on alms round, and he came across a beggar. And the beggar said, can you give me something? He said, I'm a monk, I've got no money, because the Franciscans never had any money in the beginning. I've got no money, I'm just begging myself. And the beggar said, well, at least you've got clothes to wear, I've just got rags. And the monk looked and said, actually, yeah, you're right, I've got a good robe. And so the beggar said, could I have it, please? So he said, actually, why not? I'm a monk, I'm supposed to be kind and compassionate. So he gave him his own robe. So he had nothing on, he was naked, like some pervert. So he came back to the monastery, and when the monk saw this sort of sexual deviant at the gate, knocking, trying to get in with no clothes on, he said, get out of here, you know, keep away. As you know, you would if you saw someone naked coming in here. And then, so he said, look, I'm one of the monks, don't you remember me? And they recognized the voice, they looked at him, my goodness, you are one of us, come in. What's happened to you? Have you been robbed? Have you been sort of attacked? He said, no, just there was a man who was much poorer than me. So I gave him my robe. And they thought, wow, that's a real monk. Santuti, would you do that? I hope you never get asked. And anyway, what happened, as you probably all would guess, I mean, these beggars, they talk to each other, and it goes around the grapevine, that monk was a soft touch. You know, he's a bit sort of, you know, a bit soft in the head, they thought. So the next day, when, you know, those robes were worth a bit of money, so the next day another beggar sort of, you know, saw him and said, oh, I'm so poor. And the monk said, I've got no money. He said, but you got a robe, I've got rags. And said, okay, here's my robe. So the second time he came back to the monastery naked, this time they recognized him and they gave him a robe. And of course it happened a third time. Even in Christianity it always happens three times, you know, tatty umpy. But the third time it happened, here he comes again. the abbot summoned him to his office and gave him a scolding. He said, look, you're being taken advantage of. You're being stupid. Now, these beggars, you know, they're not all that poor. And they're just, you know, taking you for someone soft in the head. And they're asking for your robes. We've looked, all these robes, just like the robes we've got, they come from you. We've only got a certain amount of robes in the store. And we can't give it away to beggars. After a while, there'll be no robes left for anybody. So you're a bad monk. Don't do that ever again. And all the time he was getting a scolding, apparently for 1 hour, the monk never tried to defend himself. You know, if that was you or me, I'd think, no, what are you talking about? There's plenty of robes left. It's a beautiful thing to do. You know, people are generous to us. Why can't we be generous to them? But anyway, he took the scolding just with his head down, and he didn't sort of argue back at all. And after the abbot really gave him a scolding for 1 whole hour, he said, you can go now. And this monk sort of never tried to justify himself. He just went back to his room, and he came back about 10 minutes later knocking on the door with a cup of hot soup. And the abbot said, what are you doing with a cup of hot soup? He said, all the time you were scolding me, I thought you must be getting a sore throat. So here's a cup of soup to heal your throat. Now imagine doing that, say, to your husband when he scolds you. Just sit there and take it, and afterwards, after 5 minutes, get him some hot soup, you know, or some sort of, you know, ginger tea or ginseng or something, because poor man, he must have a sore throat. He'd probably throw it over you, but not in this particular case. Because this monk was actually sincere. All the time that he was being scolded, he never thought about himself. He always thought about this poor abbot who was talking so much, he must have a sore throat. And I thought that was a very sweet story about compassion even when you're being scolded. And after that, the abbot said, just give away as many robes as you like. And what can you do with a monk like that? You scold them and they just be kind back to you. So that, I really like that story. It actually works, meta. So what were you going to say, Catherine?
There was once somebody, the worker here, tried to strike you.
Oh yeah, a long time ago, yeah.
At that moment,
yeah.
Did you radiate metta?
Yeah. Metta and peace. That was a story in the book when we're opening up Nolamara Center. Was anyone there at the time when we had... the then governor, Sir Gordon Reed, come with his wife. Were you there then, Rodney? Did you see that happen? Oh, okay. So you're not one of the people I'm angry at because you never came to help me. Now, this worker came up to me. The whole story is in the book. And he had his finger right, his fist right in front of my nose. Now he came out of the truck. Where's the guy in charge? I want the guy in charge. He was really angry. And I walked up to him, I'm the guy in charge. He put his finger right in front of my face like that, and he was breathing at me. His eyes were wide like some, like these yakkers, these monsters you see in the picture books. Because he'd been drinking, and you could actually smell the alcohol. That was the most alcohol I've taken in my body ever since I've been a monk, just breathing it in. And everyone else, because there was a lot of people who were setting up the place for this ceremony we were going to have the next day. And everyone else were just... mouths open looking what was going to happen next. Not one of my friends came to help me. It was very disappointing, but not necessary. Because I just had peace, I wasn't at all afraid, and metta. And the interesting thing, this is personal, that I realized I had this guy totally in my power. As if I, you know, had him like a puppet on a string. And then you knew that, and he couldn't hit me, he couldn't walk away, he couldn't do anything. And it was a wonderful experience. It was fascinating. And I indulged in it for about 1 or 2 minutes, you know, because I had total control over him, simply because I wasn't getting afraid and I was giving him loving kindness and peace. He couldn't do anything. He couldn't move. And then one of his mates, they jumped out of the truck, and he put his shoulder on his arm. Come on, we'll unload the chairs. And I said, I'll come and help you. We unloaded them together. That was actually an amazing experience, just what happens. And because you didn't have fear, because you didn't have aggression, because you were totally peaceful and totally, you know, giving him kindness, he was frozen. So sometimes you get in those situations, they're really weird and wonderful, but you learn so much from them, how you can sort of withstand such people. Anyway, next question, Thursday and Friday I found pain and restlessness. Yesterday and today I found sloth and torpor. Question, at least, you know, get variety, because it gets boring if you have the same interests as a tailor. Does that mean tomorrow and the next day I will find the middle way? I hope so. Yeah, okay, that's pretty good, because you had pain and restlessness. When you get pain, you usually get quite restless. And they had sloth and torpor, which is pretty good, because at least you're letting go a bit more, and you're sort of slowing down. So it's actually quite likely that tomorrow you will have a middle way. Because after going through sloth and torpor, at least you're letting go. A lot of teachers say that. If you see it, someone has sloth and torpor, they're not worried about them, because they'll get through that and they'll get sort of peaceful. The ones we're truly worried about, the really hard cases, are the ones who are restless, who can't stop thinking. You know, can never even fall asleep, because they're the ones that mind is just far too active. Next question from Mara. Sorry, but if you own a mobile phone connected to Telstra, No, I'm not going to say this. So for Mara, it shows you how you can connect to Telstra and how you can enjoy reception inside your hut. So SMS, internet, voice. I'm sure that if you're smart enough, that someone can get sort of mobile phone, they can get all sorts of stuff in their hut. But the point is that, you know, you want to be quiet. So if you really have a mobile phone and you keep getting addicted to it, you can actually just give it to me and I'll just sort of look after it for you for 8 or 9 days and give it back to you after you leave. We should actually do that. Before you actually come into the retreat center, we should get one of these security gates like you have at the airport. So I can actually see if you've got a mobile phone in your luggage, any biscuits in your suitcase, to give you a security check. Dear Ajahn, since yesterday's talk, I now sit with no goals and aims, etc., and just to enjoy whatever comes. Hope I get the first of the last two talks, still getting lots of sleep, which I assume is good. Get the gist of the last two talks. Just to avoid shooting myself in the foot, when you say show kindness to the five hindrances, I assume you mean just watch them as they arise and watch them as they go. Not try to force them away, i.e. ignore, rebuke, etc. And not to show kindness by encouraging or stoking them. Yeah, it's a difficult thing, as I said on the talk on mindfulness. You need enough mindfulness to be able to see what these hindrances are and what you're doing with them. If you really are just being kind to them and letting them be, they actually disappear. But a lot of time that we're not really letting them go, we're not really being kind to them. Our mindfulness is not clear enough just to see how we're attaching and clinging to them and feeding them and making them keep on going. Now, even something like sloth and torpor, sometimes that's just an escape for some people because they're afraid of being present. So sloth and torpor is a way of just dulling out so you don't have to do anything. Restlessness and thinking is sometimes from fear. Sometimes people get quiet and peaceful and they're just so unused to being peaceful, they get afraid of it and they just a thought comes in just to destroy the peace. There's another sort of syndrome when sometimes people get really peaceful and happy and then this feeling of guilt comes up. I don't deserve to be so peaceful. And all those sort of syndromes, they're very subtle. We have to be mindful enough to catch that. But of course, if those things come up, they destroy our mindfulness. So it's one of these catch-22 situations, one of these vicious cycles. We have to have mindfulness in order to create mindfulness. So this is why the first part of the retreat is a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Until you build up your mindfulness enough, it's strong enough, then you can really see what those hindrances are. And you can see how sometimes, yes, you do grab a thought and bring it in. It doesn't just come to you. And that sometimes when the thinking mind keeps on going, you're not letting it go. You're not just, you know, being equanimous to it. You're actually indulging in it. You want it to sort of keep continuing because you really think and believe it's going to lead you somewhere interesting. That's why you invest your time in it. So once the hindrances are reasonably suppressed, the mindfulness can be strong enough to suppress it further. So you suppress them a little bit, increase the mindfulness, you can see more of the hindrances, suppress them more, increases the mindfulness, can actually notice some of the subtle hindrances and knock them out, increases the mindfulness even more. And you go on like that as the mindfulness and the lack of hindrances, you know, both increase until your mindfulness gets very, very strong, and then you can knock out the most subtle of the hindrances. Does that make sense? Ajahn, I was curious, if this life force in being is mind, what is the energy or life force behind trees and plants? Sorry to take it off the topic of meditation. It's easy, just go out and ask the plants. Sometimes that happens in meditation retreats, you see people talking to the trees, talking to the plants. You're okay, it doesn't matter. No, it is a sort of a force of craving. The Buddha actually said it's only in one place in the suttas, and it said that, you know, that plants have a type of consciousness, but it's not like self-conscious. That's all the Buddha said, he didn't say more than that. So you can see that some plants, especially those of you who know your biology, there are some plants which are on the edge of being plants and animals. So it's not just plants are plants and animals are animals. There's some things on the edge of that, and it's very hard to say whether it's a plant or an animal. So you can see there could be an evolution possible, you know, from a plant to the animal realm, and from the animal realm into the full higher animal realm. But anyway, can you remember your past life as a plant? Maybe as a dead log last night on the bed. You can remember your past life as a creeper. Go on. Yeah. Ah, okay, craving creates life force. Craving is the creator. So you have made of your craving. All your wanting has created you as you are now.
And so what's life force?
Life force is just like the flow of craving. It's just the energy, rather, which craving has created. That craving has created. Okay, you can think about that one. In your book, Mindfulness, Buddhism and Beyond, you mentioned that a lot of the Thai forest monks use walking meditation as their main practice and find it generates deep insights. But if it's not possible to get into jhanas by doing walking meditation, can it really lead to truly liberating levels of insight? How then do these walk specialists break through? Okay, they also do the meditations, sitting meditation. They also do jhanas, but they do a lot of walking meditation. So they do a lot of walking meditation, but when they get very still, they just sit down where they are. So, you know, sometimes they're on their walking path and they get very still, they sit down and get into the deep meditations. But, you know, mostly they do walking. Not to be snarky, but if you say walking is not a second-class form of meditation, how come you only devote 2 pages to it in your book? Nice comment. Yeah, it's... Well, you know, because personally I like sitting meditation, and for me, sort of, I'm not a walking meditation monk. But some people do more walking meditation. If they wrote a book, they'd spend more time on walking meditation. But there's not much you can say about walking meditation, left, right, left, right, left, right. But sitting meditation, you get sort of far deeper, so there's more to say. I'm very critical of myself, progress and others, mostly critical of meditation progress. Please say a little bit of something to soften me up and cut strong, bad habit. Okay, all criticizing, it's all measuring. How can you really criticize yourself or measure yourself? Now, if you're doing sort of like an examination, you need the teacher, the only person who can mark you. So you can't mark yourself. So if you really want to be measured, ask me. And if you tell me what you've been doing, I will say, very good. And I've been sleeping, I say, very good. Last night I crept into somebody's hut and cut off the head, I murdered them. I say, very good. Because I don't want to be sort of even judgmental. Because that's another beautiful way of letting go. Stop measuring things. That story when somebody, where was it? I think it was in one of the North Perth retreats. When they asked me
Lord Kelvin once said that the only way to control nature is to measure her accurately, first of all. So modern technology has to start with very accurate measuring tools. And when they ask me that, of course, just nice thing is to turn these things around. Yes, if you don't measure things at all, you can't control anything. So it's a great way of letting go. You don't measure good meditation, bad meditation. Peaceful, agitated, stop measuring it. If you don't measure it, which means you're not comparing it to something which happened in the past, because all measuring is comparison, when you don't measure anything, you find you can't do anything. And that's a lovely meditation which I do, just no measuring. So you don't measure peaceful, agitated, who knows? So I stop measuring it. When it measures, I've just got no means of controlling my mind anymore. Because I can't control my mind anymore, you just let it be. And when you let it be, you get very peaceful. So it's a way of non-measuring. And that takes away all of the critical mind. How can you measure a person and say you're a good meditator, you're a bad meditator? You just can't say that. So when you stop measuring others, you stop measuring yourself, your mind gets incredibly peaceful. All your life you've been chose to measure, to compare. That's what you learn in school. Now you unlearn all of that. You just be. You can't measure a plant. You can't measure a kangaroo. That kangaroo we saw last night outside chomping, was that a good kangaroo or a bad kangaroo? I don't know the difference between a good kangaroo and a bad kangaroo. I stopped measuring it. It's just a beautiful kangaroo. So who's the best meditator on this retreat? I don't know. I don't even measure you. That way you can treat everybody with kindness and metta. No comparisons. You don't have ill will then. You can't get angry. So if you stop measuring, that means you stop controlling, which means you let go, which means you get peaceful. So take away all the measures. You know they're all just inaccurate. Dear Ajahn Brahm, besides stillness leading to more mindfulness, is there a way to turn on the observer mode more often to help us be more mindful? There's a pill. Wouldn't it be great if you could have a pill to shut up the brain so you're just mindful? Sometimes I thought that, you know, this is another similes, that many, many years ago when you were small, these two demons, they crawled into your ears, one in your left ear and one in your right ear. And they've been talking inside your brain ever since. Come on, do this. Come on, do that. You're not good enough. You should try harder. You're not meditating properly. This is how you should meditate. No, don't do this way. Do that way. But Ajahn Brahm said you should do this way. But the last meditation teacher said I should do this other way. And you should never sort of sit like that. You should be quiet. And you shouldn't keep your mobile phones on. And these demons, they go on and on and on all the time. So sometimes I imagine the two demons inside my brain. So sometimes I thought of getting two revolvers. Bang. But how do you calm down those demons? You just make peace with them. There, demon. Shh. Everything's all right, demon. Be kind to those demons. And stroke them until they get so soft the two demons fall totally asleep. And then you're quiet and calm and peaceful. So again, there's no other way except by kindness, making peace, being gentle. To actually to get some stillness. Because your simile, how can you get a cup to be still? You've got to put it down. Let it go, let it be. There's no other way to get a cup to be still except by letting it go. You do anything means you're holding, you're attaching, you're grasping it. And it will get agitated. You let it go and it gets peaceful. I'm confused about karma. If someone hurts us, and we know karma will get them, would that mean we must have done something in the first place that we hurt and karma got us? If unintentional or even unknown, does karma apply? Now, if it's unintentional, karma doesn't apply. So, you know, if you just, you know, brush past somebody or kick somebody because you can't see them in the dark, that's no karma because you never meant to do that.
And if you get hurt, sometimes it's not always karma the reason that you get hurt. Sometimes it's accidents. But if someone deliberately hurts others, that's karma, and there'll be some recompense back there for them. So if you get hurt, that doesn't mean that you've hurt somebody else. But if you consciously deliberately hurt somebody, that is some karma, and eventually they will sort of suffer. That's a nice way of actually, I mean, you don't have to seek revenge. Revenge is a terrible thing to always have to seek. You know, I've got to get them back. And it just tortures you. If you do manage to hurt them, you know, the amount of investment of your own pain you have to put in just to hurt them, it hurts you 10 times more than it ever hurts them. So it's a total waste of time wanting to hurt somebody else or wanting to have to revenge. It's just not worth it. So if you actually see what's going on, it's just a total waste of time getting angry at other people. I was just talking with someone about the bhikkhuni ordination and the sort of stuff which people have said about me. But why am I going to let other people make me upset and angry? So I'm just letting it go because I refuse to get upset. I refuse to allow other people, whatever they say or do, to spoil my day. So you manage to do that. So you never seek revenge, you never seek for other people, you know, to get hurt. So may they all be happy and well. That's a much better way of dealing with life. Yeah?
Since you mentioned Ajahn Sumedho, also at the retreat with him,
yeah.
You mentioned that your virtue was being intelligent.
Very good, and so is he. And he's a very kind monk. So may he live long. It's much nicer than that. May he die in a pit of vipers. And may he... You don't say things like that, because that just makes your mind just really awful. Okay. Assuming enlightenment is 100% free from attachment, greed, etc., how many percent do you consider yourself from the enlightenment? Just want to have a feel whether how far we are from the target. Okay, I am totally unenlightened. The I is always unenlightened. And whenever you measure 100%, 50%, 20%, 70%, of course that's not enlightenment at all. It cannot be measured. So as soon as you start to say you're 100% or 90%, just by saying that shows you haven't got a clue what enlightenment is. So just be free from all measurements. 100%, 0%. You don't consider yourself. Whenever there's an I involved, there's always a lot of problems. So anyone who says, yeah, I'm enlightened, no way. So you just disappear till there's no I left. I'm afraid to watch a beautiful breath. The reason being is because you tend to bang on about making peace, be kind, be gentle. Please comment. You can't win as a monk, can you? Okay, just don't watch it then. You must not watch the beautiful breath. And from now on, whoever wrote that, please make war, be angry and be cruel. That is your instructions. Negative psychology, I hope. Ajahn Brahm, many read the biography of Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Chah, ways of practice, and I'm inspired. Should lay devotees adopt similar approach? It's easy to be inspired at a distance. You think, wow, that's really good. I'm going to really go for it. The first time I heard the Buddha's story of enlightenment, I was at Cambridge, one of my first Waysacks, about 19 years of age. And what really hit me was where the Buddha said, I will not move from this seat, even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust. I will not move until I get full, complete enlightenment. And I thought, wow, that's a real meditator. So when I went back to my room, I sat down. Really stupid. That's what you are when you're young, right? 19 years of age. Only been meditating about a year. You know, my maximum was about 25 minutes. And I was just so conceited. I thought, well, if the Buddha could do it, I mean, he didn't sort of have a good education like me. I'm much better than him. I'm as smart as he was. So I thought, I'm going to do the same. So I did sit down on the seat and said, and I was serious. I said, I'm not going to get up. Even though my blood dries up, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to break through. I'm going to meditate. I managed 40 minutes. 40 minutes. Absolute agony. And I couldn't stand anymore. I was just so at the end of my tether, and I sort of got up. And I wasn't enlightened. My blood was still wet. My bones had turned to dust. I was so disappointed. So, yeah, you can get inspired by other people, but it's just like looking at these things from a distance. You don't really understand what they're up to, what they're doing. So don't just follow other people's form of practice like that. And especially in biographies, they are all sort of exaggerated, these biographies. That's why that many of you may have read the biography of Ajahn Tate. And if you notice on the beginning of that, he said, I wrote this biography myself before I died because I don't want other people to exaggerate me. And that was in direct response to Ajahn Mahabua's biography of Ajahn Mun. Because Ajahn Tate was a novice with Ajahn Mun for so many years. And Ajahn Tate's Ajahn Mun was very different than Ajahn Mahabua's Ajahn Mun. Just the same in Ajahn Chah's funeral. There's a wonderful thing that you should know, that all the monks at Ajahn Chah's funeral service, and then the conversation started coming up. What did Ajahn Chah teach? And then the monks started arguing about what Ajahn Chah taught. And then sort of my predecessor, Ajahn Jaco, a very wise monk, he came up with this wonderful saying. He said, every monk has got a different memory of Ajahn Chah. And there is as many Ajahn Chahs as there are his disciples. And you will never have a definitive Ajahn Chah. My memory, description of the teaching of Ajahn Chah will be very different than Ajahn Sumedho's, which will be different than every other monk who was with him. And even when I die, you know, you say, what did Ajahn Brahm teach? And you'll have arguments about what I taught. And that's always going to be the same. Because each one of you will remember part of what I teach which was important for you. And you forget everything else. And that's just what happens with Ajahn Chah, what happens with Ajahn Mahabua, with Ajahn Mun. So these biographies, they're always incomplete. The one you have of Ajahn Mun, it's Ajahn Mahabua's Ajahn Mun. And that'd be totally different from another monk's Ajahn Mun. And a lot of times it's the biographer. People write any biography, there's more of the biographer in there than the subject. So there's so much of Ajahn Mahabua in that book, rather than Ajahn Mun. That's seen through the lens of Ajahn Mahabua. And ask any biographer, it's always the same. It's just so difficult, if you're writing a biography of anybody, to take yourself out and just to be objective. You just can't do it. So be careful of being inspired and just trying to imitate an Ajahn Chah or imitate. That was actually one of the last teachings of Ajahn Chah, because I was with him almost right to the end. I just came over to Perth about 1 month before he had his stroke and stopped speaking at all. And he used to get his hand and said there was a mother crab who had a bad leg. And so it walked with a limp. And I can't do this. He did his hand like a mother crab walking with a limp. And she tells all her baby crabs, you know, I've got a limp, a bad leg, don't follow me. But nevertheless, all the baby crabs, they too walk with a limp. You know, just like the mother crab, they just imitate. And Ajahn Chah was saying, no, don't imitate me. And it's important you don't imitate your teacher. Okay, so don't just go talking like me and telling stupid jokes. One person telling stupid jokes is enough. A beautiful dana gave me a wonderful feeling of the Sangha's metta to all of us. It gave me a good basis for my meditation, thankfulness. Beautiful dana, yeah, that was the food today. So all these people, they came to feed you for nothing. They didn't get any money for this. And they brought all this food, delicious food, coming from at least 1 hour's distance away, came to feed you. Isn't that just delightful? Just because you're meditating, because they respect meditation, respect what you're doing. It's brilliant. Dear Ajahn Brahm, do you apply similar teaching methods to the monks of Bodhinyana? I'm much stricter of Bodhinyana. I really get the whip out. Is that so, Santuti? Yeah. Now, you're a monk there, so you know. Totally the same. Now, sometimes when I first started teaching, that you thought of that. Should you teach the monks and the laity at the same level? Or should you just teach the monks higher and just give lay people second grade teachings? I really thought about that because there's a lot of sense to it. I mean, the monks, they're professionals. They just do this all day. And you guys, you just come here for maybe 9 days and then you go back again to the world, have your sex, watch your TV and movies and mess around in the world. But it didn't make sense to me. Because once the Buddha said he taught with an open fist, he never kept anything secret. So, yeah, I teach you as I teach the monks. Maybe just use more Pali for the monks, because they understand more of the suttas and more of the Pali. They got more background there. But basically the same teachings. I think it's otherwise it's unfair. So you get the full teachings. Whether you do it or not is up to you, but you get the full teachings. Ajahn Brahm, in past talks you have sometimes told of a lay person who went into jhana was taken to the mortuary, believed dead. He didn't actually get to the mortuary, he was pretty close. They thought he was dead, but they kept him in the emergency room until he came out of meditation. You described it as second jhana. Now I think it looked like it was a fourth jhana. Do you mean second material, immaterial jhana? Surely second material jhana wouldn't be so deep. Yeah, it would be a fourth jhana or above. And the immaterials are never called jhanas to be specific. They're called immaterial attainments. There's only four jhanas, 1, 2, 3, 4. The immaterial states are called literally immaterial attainments. They're never called jhana by the Buddha. Interesting quote. They're still sort of grounds for enlightenment, but they're never called jhanas. So when I say jhana, I mean jhana. The immaterial states I call immaterial states or attainments. So I would say it's at least a fourth jhana, maybe an immaterial state, but look like a fourth jhana. What happens if someone is aroused out of jhana? Is it possible to do, and what is the effect on the person? No, of course it's not possible to arouse them. They've just got to come out when it's the time for them to come out. So you can shout in their ear, come on, get out. It's time to go to dinner with your mother-in-law. It wouldn't work even if they were awake. But no, they just can't hear you. You tap on their shoulders, they can't feel you. So there's nothing you can do. There's another sort of guy. Some of you know him very well. I won't say who it is, but he used to be in the British Army. And he used to get these terrible migraines. And he said the only way he could deal with the migraines was actually to find a sort of a dark place. And he said, just go inside the pain, right in deep inside. And he said that was how he got into these deep meditations. He gave me one example. He was on maneuvers in Germany. And he was like the warrant officer, so he was in charge of a group of soldiers. So on the radio it said, you know, you can have a tea break. So they all sort of stopped for a while. And he had a terrible migraine. There was some sort of shed close by. He said, I'm going in the shed because I've got this terrible migraine. So I went into the shed, just nice and dark, and went deep inside so he couldn't feel the pain. And then the order changed. They had to get back in their truck and go to another destination, and they forgot him. So when they realized they forgot him, they quickly turned around and got into the shed, and there he was just sitting perfectly still. And these were soldiers. They literally lifted him up and put him in the back of a truck. Now, these were soldiers. They're not sort of the most delicate of people. And then sort of later on, he came out of his meditation. He said, where the heck am I? I was in a shed, now I'm in the back of a truck. And the soldiers told him, they just picked him up, he didn't feel anything. And so he got into that deep state of meditation, which would have been a jhana, simply because he had to, because the pain was just too unbearable. But the migraines have gone now and he can't get back there at all. But he said, you know, it's interesting, he had those experiences. And you know, when you get picked up and you can't feel anything, but you're perfectly aware inside, that's a good sign of a jhana. Ajahn Brahm, please share with us the most remarkable Tudong experience. How can a laity get a glimpse of a real Tudong? Real Tudong experience. Oh, just when you're out there in the jungles. Oh, it's a good Tudong experience. So Ajahn Chah always used to tell you, if you go on Tudong, there's still many villages around. You have to go close to a village because that's where you get your alms food the next day. But he said, if the villagers see you, they'll come and bother you in the evening. They'll really ask for a talk, but what they don't want to talk, they just want lottery number. So often people would actually come and they say, teach us some Dhamma and then sort of give us a number. Because they thought that Tudong monks, because they were meditators, you had psychic power, so you could see the next lottery number which was coming up. And that's all they were interested in. So they saw a Tudong monk, especially like a Western Tudong monk, that was a sure bet you can get a lottery number. So they're always worrying you. And you don't mind teaching them Dhamma. When they keep coming and just saying, we want numbers, you get a bit fed up with that. And that was common. So Ajahn Chah said, what you should do when you get to the village, ask where the cremation ground is. Because there's always a place where they burn the bodies. And you go over there and put your mosquito net up there and no one will bother you at all because the villagers are shit scared of ghosts. So that's where we used to go. We used to go to ask where the cremation ground was because there you could be guaranteed some peace and quiet. The villagers wouldn't come and even they wouldn't dare to ask for lottery numbers because they were too scared. So one night I was sitting there, just in the edge of the jungle. I had my mosquito net. But that's no real protection from big jungle animals. You were meditating, usually in the evening, you get the sound of cicadas, and then they after a while, they die down, and you get into the middle of the night time, and you're meditating nice and peacefully. But that's all the time when the jungle animals come out looking for their dinner. And I heard a sound of an animal walking towards me. I was very mindful. I'd been meditating. And he thought of that sound and assessed it. He said, no, it's a safe, it's only a small animal. Because you could hear this the way it crunches the leaves or breaks the twigs on the forest floor. So I just went back to my breathing. And then I heard it coming closer. And as it came closer, you could assess it a bit more accurately. That wasn't a small animal, that was a medium-sized one. Could be maybe a civet cat, could be maybe something bigger. Still not really dangerous. But as it came closer, you could hear it even more loudly. And just you could tell by the way it broke the twigs, that had to be a big animal. The big animals meant tigers. And those tigers were dangerous, they did eat monks. So I got very scared, there must be a tiger. So at that, I just lost my concentration on the breath and opened my eyes and I saw it right in front of me. This tiny mouse. And it was fear had exaggerated it. And I just was really caught because the fear had made a mouse exaggerate the sound into a tiger. I thought I was being mindful. I was being logical, assessing its sound. I couldn't believe how small that mouse was. So that's what you learn, how fear makes it very big. And one of the other experiences, Tudong, is I was in Phupan district. I'd just been staying with Ajahn Suwat. He was one of the forest monks. And I was walking to Sokonakon, which was about 60 kilometers. So it was too much for one day's walk. So I asked Ajahn Suwat, where's a nice place to stay halfway? I like staying in caves. Is there a good cave halfway? And he looked at me quite seriously. He said, yeah, there is a cave halfway, but you've got to be very careful because there's a ghost inside it. Now, this came from a forest teacher, a very famous one. So if a forest teacher said there was a ghost in there, I knew there would be one there. Lay people don't think anything's a ghost. But a monk says there's a ghost, that means there's a real ghost there. And I thought, great. Always wanted to see a real, dinky-dye ghost. So I went there, and I got to the village and asked where the cave was, and they showed me where the cave was. It really was a spooky cave. And deeper inside, I never went that deep, there was actually a skeleton. No, they never told me where that skeleton came from. There was a human skeleton deep under the cave, they said.
And of course, before it got dark, the layperson left me. And there I was, sitting meditation, waiting for the ghost, and waiting, and waiting, and waiting. It never came. And I was just really fed up. And just, you know, just sitting there, went there especially to see the ghost, and the ghost never came to see me. So then I lay down and fell asleep. And I'd only been asleep for maybe a couple of seconds. And then the ghost came, running towards me. Bang, 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 bang. And stopped right outside, you know, where I was sitting, sleeping. You know what I said? And I said, just go away. If you can't come at the right time, just go away. And I went back to sleep. I was really pissed off at the ghost. You know, you've been up there for I don't know after what time, waiting for him, and then as soon as you go to sleep, that's when he decides to come. I wasn't taking that. So I just fell asleep again. And that was the end of the ghost. So that's the other experience. Never sort of let ghosts control your happiness. If they're going to come at the right time, they come at the right time. You're not, if you wait for them, you're not going to sort of look after them afterwards. That's what my mind was like. That's another two-dog experience of ghosts. So that's a good fun. In the Karanyamata Sutta, what does not busy with duties mean? Ah, that's a good thing. Lots of senior monastics with great wisdom and compassion and hence high demand of the services seem pretty busy, and rightly so, one would think. You know, when that first translation, we had unburdened with duties. That was the first translation of that Metta Sutta. But it doesn't mean that. It means having few duties, actually. Even not busy with duties, having few duties. That's its meaning. But, you know, sometimes the monks who translate this say, well, if we say few duties, it makes most of the monks feel embarrassed because we have lots of duties. So the idea of being a monk is trying to limit the duties, having less, less, less. But it's just so difficult to do. I find it impossible to do, you know, because people keep asking, can you teach another retreat? You know, can I have another interview? Can I sort of do this and do that? So eventually you give in. But a real monk, you know, at least you should have time when you have no duties at all. So even myself, for 2 weeks every year, I go on retreat, and I really sort of keep that so strict. I tell the monks, if you all disrobe and get married, if you kill yourself, I don't want to hear about anything. You just go and disrobe, kill yourself, I don't care. For 2 weeks, I'm meditating, and that's it. Don't even knock on my door. And I do that. So I have my 2 weeks every year when I just totally just, I don't care what happens in the monastery. Don't care what happens to you. If you call me up and you're really desperate, sorry, bad karma. That's it. Because you have to do that, otherwise you go crazy. And also, you're not leading by example. And when I did have sabbatical, when I did have 6 months off, what did I do? I never went traveling anywhere. I just went into my heart and just had a retreat for 6 months. So that's what I like to do. So, you know, when you don't have to, then you don't. So that's the best I can do. But it is actually good to try and look after your monks and your nuns so they don't have so many duties. So don't keep asking them for too much. Yeah. That's a nice way of looking at it, but unfortunately that's not what it means in Pali. It really does mean appa means few, and kicho means duties. So it's trying to have few duties in as well. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's great being unburdened. I mean, you're retired now. I'm really looking for my retirement. 58 now, only a few years to go. Why are you shaking your head? I was thinking of actually starting a fund on this retreat for my retirement home. A nice little cootie next to a fish and chip shop somewhere. Go on. Clear? Yeah. He did have a lot of, but he also just, he took time off too. He went on retreats. Yeah. And he told people, no one will come and see me. Mm-hmm. And if you remember that one time, he went on retreat and all the monks decided to commit suicide. When he came off retreat, he said, why are the number of monks diminished so much? Because they were doing a supergamma meditation, you know, meditation on the lowest limits of the body.
And after that he said, no, that's going too far. Do some anapanasati. Gives you more happiness and joy. If one is kind to sloth and torpor, wouldn't it lead to sleep? How do you avoid having sloth and torpor and falling into sleep? No, the opposite. If you're kind to sloth and torpor, you're making peace and stillness and energy is coming. Kindness is an energy generator. Anger, ill will is an energy consumer. So if you have lots of kindness, so that creates energy, which stops the sloth and torpor. You know, people get depressed. They just got no kindness at all. Just get a bit of kindness and joy in your life and depression disappears. When I first went to UK, after 7 years as a monk, I went Christmas time, November, December, the most miserable time of the year. You all know that story. Everything is grey. Grey streets, grey buildings, grey skies, grey overcoats, no colour whatsoever. And what do English people drink for tea? Earl Grey. Everything is grey. There's no colour at all. So people would get depressed. It was called seasonally affected disorder. And it just happens in those months. And you can see why. I mean, it just gets... I remember as a kid going to school at 9 o'clock, it was still dark. 3:30, 4 o'clock when you went home, it was dark again. You know, the sun only sort of, maybe for about 10 o'clock, it started getting dawn. And maybe 11 o'clock, it was sort of like twilight. And midday was just like maybe 5 o'clock in the afternoon here in Australia. And then it started getting dark again. And it's just so miserable. So people get depressed. And because it's cold, people just don't wear bright colours. And the therapy, which worked every time, they got these people who were depressed. They put them in a room, bright lights. They made them wear Hawaiian shirts and played them loud music just to stimulate their senses. And loud music, bright coloured shirts, bright lights, and they got out of their seasonally affective disorder. That's all they need, a bit of bright sunshine, that's all. So if ever you go to UK, if you go in the winter time, English people are one way. If you go in July and August, they're a totally different character. They're actually friendly in July and August. November, December, they're miserable. Come on, you've got to be honest. That's true, isn't it, Diane? Can you say something of the relationship between the Sangha and the laity? Yep. You feed us and we're kind to you. That's about it, isn't it? Do you want to add to anything to that, Sister Ajahnwayama? No. So, yeah, we're in this together. Birth, sickness, old age and death. Birth, sickness, old age and death. Birth, sickness, old age and death. Please, Ajahn, for the sake of enlightenment, get me off this darn wheel. I've been trying to do that, but you just won't get off. Just like that worm in a pile of dung. I'm trying to get you out of that pile of dung. And what do you do? I don't want to go. I like my pile of shit. I like my job. I like my partner. I like my sort of house. It's really hard to get people to become monks and nuns. You get them out and they call back again. But we try our best, and if you don't get off this time, you get off the next time. So yeah, sickness, old age and death keeps on coming, and after a while, that's why it's really good to remember your past lives. So when you get so deep in meditation, you can remember your past lives and you see the big picture. Just here we go again. Do you really want to get reborn again? Nappies again? Soiling them. Every time you try and say something, your mother shoves this thing in your mouth, this dummy, and shuts you up. Is that how you want to live? Do you want to go to school again? Grade 1 and grade 2. All over again, having to do homework again. So, it's nice to make this the last life. So, if you really realize just the mess you're in, having to get reborn again, this life might be okay. For the next life, you may be reborn as a cockroach and no one likes you. Got to run for your life every time somebody sees you. So you don't know what you're going to get reborn as. It's So be careful. So make this your last life. Okay, it's getting late anyway, so people get silly when it gets late. So me too. So thank you for all those questions. Some of them are answered deeply, some are not so deep. So if you're not satisfied with the answer, you can ask the question in your next life. So have a nice night and pleasant sleep, pleasant meditation if you want to meditate. And see you in the morning for another day at wonderful Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center. Have a nice sleep. Very good. Okay. And I was actually serious about that retirement cootie next to the fish and chip shop when I'm 65.